From Russia with Love by Ian Fleming, continued. Disc 4. Bond climbed out of the plane with a handful of pale, silent passengers and walked across to the transit lounge and up to the bar. He ordered a tumbler of ouzo and drank it down and chased it with a mouthful of ice water. There was a strong bite under the sickly anisette taste, and Bond felt the drink light a quick, small fire down his throat and in his stomach. He put down his glass and ordered another. By the time the loudspeakers called him out again, it was dusk, and the half-moon rode clear and high above the lights of the town. The air was soft with evening and the smell of flowers, and there was the steady pulse-beat of the cicadas. Zinga, zinga, zing, and the distant sound of a man singing. The voice was clear and sad, and the song had a note of lament. Near the airport, a dog barked excitedly at an unknown human smell. Bond suddenly realized that he had come into the East, where the guard dog howls all night. For some reason, the realization sent a pang of pleasure and excitement into his heart. They had only a 90-minute flight to Istanbul, across the dark Aegean and the Sea of Marmara. An excellent dinner with two dry martinis and a half-bottle of Calvé claret put Bond's reservations about flying on Friday the 13th and his worries about his assignment out of his mind and substituted a mood of pleased anticipation. Then they were there, and the plane's four propellers wheeled to a stop outside the fine modern airport of Yesilkoy, an hour's drive from Istanbul. Bond said goodbye and thank you for a good flight to the stewardess, carried the heavy little attaché case through the passport check into the customs, and waited for his suitcase to come off the plane. So these dark, ugly, neat little officials were the modern Turks. He listened to their voices, full of broad vowels and quiet sibilants and modified U sounds, and he watched the dark eyes that belied the soft, polite voices. They were bright, angry, cruel eyes that had only lately come down from the mountains. Bond thought he knew the history of those eyes. They were eyes that had been trained for centuries to watch over sheep and decipher small movements on far horizons. They were eyes that kept the knife hand in sight without seeming to, that counted the grains of meal and the small fractions of coin and noted the flicker of the merchant's fingers. They were hard, untrusting, jealous eyes. Bond didn't take to them. Outside the customs, a tall, rangy man with drooping black moustaches stepped out of the shadows. He wore a smart dust coat and a chauffeur's cap. He saluted and, without asking Bond his name, took his suitcase and led the way over to a gleaming aristocrat of a car, an old black basketwork Rolls-Royce Coupe de Ville that Bond guessed must have been built for some millionaire of the 20s. When the car was gliding out of the airport, the man turned and said politely over his shoulder in excellent English, "Gerim Bey thought you would prefer to rest tonight, sir. I am to call for you at 9 tomorrow morning. What hotel are you staying at, sir?"
"The Crystal Palace."
"Very good, sir." The car sighed off down the wide, modern road. Behind them, in the dappled shadows of the airport parking place, Bond vaguely heard the crackle of a motor scooter starting up. The sound meant nothing to him, and he settled back to enjoy the drive. Chapter 14. Darko Kerim. James Bond awoke early in his dingy room at the Crystal Palace, on the heights of Pera, and absent-mindedly reached down a hand to explore a sharp tickle on the outside of his right thigh. Something had bitten him during the night. Irritably he scratched the spot. He might have expected it. When he had arrived the night before, to be greeted by a surly night concierge in trousers and a collarless shirt, and had briefly inspected the entrance hall with the fly-blown palms in copper pots and the floor and walls of discoloured Moorish tiles, he had known what he was in for. He had half thought of going to another hotel. Inertia and a perverse liking for the sleazy romance that clings to old-fashioned continental hotels had decided him to stay, and he had signed in and followed the man up to the third floor in the old rope-and-gravity lift. His room, with its few sticks of aged furniture and an iron bedstead, was what he had expected. He only looked to see if there were the blood spots of squashed bugs on the wallpaper behind the bedhead before dismissing the concierge. He had been premature. When he went into the bathroom and turned on the hot tap, it gave a deep sigh, then a deprecating cough, and finally ejected a small centipede into the basin. Bond morosely washed the centipede away with a thin stream of brownish water from the cold tap. So much, he had reflected wryly, for choosing an hotel because its name had amused him, and because he had wanted to get away from the soft life of big hotels. But he had slept well, and now, with the reservation that he must buy some insecticide, he decided to forget about his comforts and get on with the day. Bond got out of bed, drew back the heavy red plush curtains, and leant on the iron balustrade and looked out over one of the most famous views in the world. On his right, the still waters of the Golden Horn. On his left, the dancing waves of the unsheltered Bosphorus. And in between, the tumbling roofs, soaring minarets and crouching mosques of Pera. After all, his choice had been good. The view made up for many bedbugs and much discomfort. For 10 minutes, Bond stood and gazed out across the sparkling water barrier between Europe and Asia. Then he turned back into the room, now bright with sunshine, and telephoned for his breakfast. His English was not understood, but his French at last got through. He turned on a cold bath and shaved patiently with cold water, and hoped that the exotic breakfast he had ordered would not be a fiasco. He was not disappointed. The yogurt, in a blue china bowl, was deep yellow, and with the consistency of thick cream. The green figs, ready peeled, were bursting with ripeness, and the Turkish coffee was jet black, and with the burned taste that showed it had been freshly ground. Bond ate the delicious meal on a table drawn up beside the open window. He watched the steamers and the cakes criss-crossing the two seas spread out before him, and wondered about Kerim, and what fresh news there might be. Punctually at 9, the elegant Rolls came for him, and took him through Taksim Square and down the crowded Istiklal and out of Asia. The thick black smoke of the waiting steamers, badged with the graceful crossed anchors of the merchant marine, streamed across the first span of the Galata Bridge, and hid the other shore towards which the Rolls nosed forward through the bicycles and trams, the well-bred snort of the ancient bulb horn just keeping the pedestrians from under its wheels. Then the way was clear, and the old European section of Istanbul glittered at the end of the broad half-mile of bridge, with the slim minarets lancing up into the sky, and the domes of the mosques crouching at their feet, looking like big firm breasts. It should have been the Arabian Nights, but to Bond, seeing it first above the tops of trams and above the great scars of modern advertising along the river frontage, it seemed a once-beautiful theatre set that modern Turkey had thrown aside in favour of the steel and concrete flatiron of the Istanbul Hilton Hotel, blankly glittering behind him on the heights of Pera. Across the bridge, the car nosed to the right, down a narrow cobbled street parallel with the waterfront, and stopped outside a high wooden porte-cochère. A tough-looking watchman with a chunky, smiling face dressed in frayed khaki came out of a porter's lodge and saluted. He opened the car door and gestured for Bond to follow him. He led the way back into his lodge and through a door into a small courtyard with a neatly raked gravel parterre. In the centre was a gnarled eucalyptus tree at whose foot two white ringdoves were pecking about. The noise of the town was a distant rumble, and it was quiet and peaceful. They walked across the gravel and through another small door, and Bond found himself at one end of a great vaulted godown, with high circular windows through which dusty bars of sunshine slanted across a vista of bundles and bales of merchandise. There was a cool, musty scent of spices and coffee, and as Bond followed the watchman down the central passageway, a sudden strong wave of mint. At the end of the long warehouse was a raised platform enclosed by a balustrade. On it half a dozen young men and girls sat on high stools and wrote busily in fat, old-fashioned ledgers. It was like a Dickensian counting-house, and Bond noticed that each high desk had a battered abacus beside the inkpot. Not one of the clerks looked up as Bond walked between them, but a tall, swarthy man with a lean face and unexpected blue eyes came forward from the furthest desk and took delivery of him from the watchman. He smiled warmly at Bond, showing a set of extremely white teeth, and led him to the back of the platform. He knocked on a fine mahogany door with a Yale lock, and, without waiting for an answer, opened it and let Bond in, and closed the door softly behind him.
"Ah, my friend, come in, come in!"
A very large man in a beautifully cut cream tussore suit got up from a mahogany desk and came to meet him, holding out his hand. A hint of authority behind the loud, friendly voice reminded Bond that this was the head of Station T, and that Bond was in another man's territory and juridically under his command. It was no more than a point of etiquette, but a point to remember. Darko Kerim had a wonderfully warm, dry hand-clasp. It was a strong Western handful of operative fingers, not the banana-skin handshake of the East that makes you want to wipe your fingers on your coat-tails. And the big hand had a coiled power that said it could easily squeeze your hand tighter and tighter until finally it cracked your bones. Bond was 6 feet tall, but this man was at least 2 inches taller, and he gave the impression of being twice as broad and twice as thick as Bond. Bond looked up into two wide apart, smiling blue eyes and a large, smooth brown face with a broken nose. The eyes were watery and veined with red, like the eyes of a hound who lies too often too close to the fire. Bond recognized them as the eyes of furious dissipation. The face was vaguely gypsy-like in its fierce pride, and in the heavy, curling black hair and crooked nose, and the effect of a vagabond soldier of fortune was heightened by the small, thin gold ring Kerim wore in the lobe of his right ear. It was a startlingly dramatic face, vital, cruel, and debauched, but what one noticed more than its drama was that it radiated life. Bond thought he had never seen so much vitality and warmth in a human face. It was like being close to the sun. And Bond let go the strong, dry hand and smiled back at Kerim with a friendliness he rarely felt for a stranger. "Thanks for sending the car to meet me last night."
"Ha!" Kerim was delighted. "You must thank our friends, too. You were met by both sides. They always follow my car when it goes to the airport."
"Was it a Vespa?" "Or a Lambretta?"
"You noticed? A Lambretta. They have a whole fleet of them for their little men, the men I call the Faceless Ones. They look so alike, we have never managed to sort them out. Little gangsters, mostly stinking Bulgars who do their dirty work for them. But I expect this one kept well back. They don't get up close to the rolls any more since the day my chauffeur stopped suddenly and then reversed back as hard as he could. Messed up the paintwork and bloodied the bottom of the chassis, but it taught the rest of the manners."
Kerim went to his chair and waved to an identical one across the desk. He pushed over a flat white box of cigarettes, and Bond sat down and took a cigarette and lit it. It was the most wonderful cigarette he had ever tasted, the mildest and sweetest of Turkish tobacco, in a slim, long oval tube with an elegant gold crescent. While Kerim was fitting one into a long, nicotine-stained ivory holder, Bond took the opportunity to glance round the room, which smelt strongly of paint and varnish, as if it had just been redecorated. It was big and square and panelled in polished mahogany, except behind Kerim's chair, where a length of oriental tapestry hung down from the ceiling and gently moved in the breeze, as if there was an open window behind it. But this seemed unlikely, as light came from 3 circular windows high up in the walls. Perhaps behind the tapestry was a balcony looking out over the Golden Horn, whose waves Bond could hear lapping at the walls below. In the centre of the right-hand wall hung a gold-framed reproduction of Anagoni's portrait of the Queen. Opposite, also imposingly framed, was Cecil Beaton's wartime photograph of Winston Churchill, looking up from his desk in the cabinet offices like a contemptuous bulldog. A broad bookcase stood against one wall, and, opposite, a comfortably padded leather settee. In the centre of the room the big desk winked with polished brass handles. On the littered desk were 3 silver photograph frames, and Bond caught a sideways view of the copperplate script of 2 mentions in dispatches and the military division of the OBE. Kerim lit his cigarette. He jerked his head back at the piece of tapestry.
"Our friends paid me a visit yesterday," he said casually. "Fixed a limpet bomb on the wall outside. Timed the fuse to catch me at my desk. By good luck, I had taken a few minutes off to relax on the couch over there with a young Romanian girl who still believes that a man will tell secrets in exchange for love. The bomb went off at a vital moment. I refused to be disturbed, but I fear the experience was too much for the girl. When I released her, she had hysterics. I'm afraid she had decided that my love-making is altogether too violent."
He waved his cigarette holder apologetically.
"But it was a rush to get the room put to rights in time for your visit. New glass for the windows and my pictures, and the place stinks of paint. However,
Kerim sat back in his chair. There was a slight frown on his face.
"What I cannot understand is this sudden breach of the peace. We live together very amicably in Istanbul. We all have our work to do. It is unheard of that my cher colleague should suddenly declare war in this way. It is quite worrying. It can only lead to trouble for our Russian friends. I shall be forced to rebuke the man who did it when I have found out his name."
Kerim shook his head.
"It is most confusing. I am hoping it has nothing to do with this case of ours."
"But was it necessary to make my arrival so public?" Bond asked mildly. "The last thing I want is to get you involved in all this. Why send the Rolls to the airport? It only ties you in with me." Kerim's laugh was indulgent.
"My friend, I must explain something which you should know. We and the Russians and the Americans have a paid man in all the hotels, and we have all bribed an official of the secret police at headquarters, and we receive a carbon copy of the list of all foreigners entering the country every day, by air or train or sea. Given a few more days, I could have smuggled you in through the Greek frontier, but for what purpose? Your existence here has to be known to the other side, so that our friend can contact you. It is a condition she has laid down that she will make her own arrangements for the meeting. Perhaps she does not trust our security, who knows? But she was definite about it, and she said, as if I didn't know it, that her center would immediately be advised of your arrival."
Kerim shrugged his broad shoulders.
"So why make things difficult for her? I am merely concerned with making things easy and comfortable for you, so that you will at least enjoy your stay, even if it is fruitless."
Bond laughed. "I take it all back. I'd forgotten the Balkan formula. Anyway, I'm under your orders here. You tell me what to do, and I'll do it." Kerim waved the subject aside.
"Now, since we are talking of your comfort, how is your hotel? I was surprised you chose the palace. It is little better than a disorderly house, what the French call a bezodrome, and it's quite a haunt of the Russians. Not that that matters."
"It's not too bad. I just didn't want to stay at the Istanbul Hilton or one of the other smart places."
"Money?"
Kerim reached into a drawer and took out a flat packet of new green notes.
"Here's 1,000 Turkish pounds. Their real value and their rate on the black market is about 20 to the pound. The official rate is 7. Tell me when you've finished them, and I'll give you as many more as you want. We can do our accounts after the game. It's a mark, anyway. Ever since Croesus, the first millionaire, invented gold coins, money has depreciated. And the face of the coin has been debased as fast as its value. First the faces of gods were on the coins, then the faces of kings, then of presidents. Now there's no face at all. Look at this stuff."
Kerim tossed the money over to Bond.
"Today it's only paper, with a picture of a public building and the signature of a cashier. Muck. The miracle is that you can still buy things with it. However, what else? Cigarettes? Smoke only these. I will have a few hundred sent up to your hotel. They're the best. Diplomatis. They're not easy to get. Most of them go to the ministries and the embassies. Anything else before we get down to business? Don't worry about your meals and your leisure. I will look after both. I shall enjoy it, and, if you will forgive me, I wish to stay close to you while you are here."
"Nothing else," said Bond, "except that you must come over to London one day."
"Never," said Kerim definitely. "The weather and the women are far too cold, and I am proud to have you here. It reminds me of the war. Now,"
he rang a bell on his desk,
"do you like your coffee plain or sweet? In Turkey we cannot talk seriously without coffee or raki, and it is too early for raki."
"Plain." The door behind Bond opened. Kerim barked an order. When the door was shut, Kerim unlocked a drawer and took out a file and put it in front of him. He smacked his hand down on it.
"My friend," he said grimly, "I do not know what to say about this case."
He leant back in his chair and linked his hands behind his neck.
"Has it ever occurred to you that our kind of work is rather like shooting a film? So often I have got everybody on location, and I think I can start turning the handle. And then it's the weather, and then it's the actors, and then it's the accidents, and there is something else that also happens in the making of a film. Love appears in some shape or form, at the very worst, as it is now, between the two stars. To me that is the most confusing factor in this case, and the most inscrutable one. Does this girl really love her idea of you? Will she love you when she sees you? Will you be able to love her enough to make her come over?
Bond made no comment. There was a knock on the door, and the head clerk put a china eggshell, enclosed in gold filigree, in front of each of them, and went out. Bond sipped his coffee and put it down. It was good, but thick with grains. Kerim swallowed his at a gulp and fitted a cigarette into his holder and lit it.
"But there is nothing we can do about this love matter,"
Kerim continued, speaking half to himself.
"We can only wait and see. In the meantime there are other things."
He leant forward against the desk and looked across at Bond, his eyes suddenly very hard and shrewd.
"There is something going on in the enemy camp, my friend. It is not only this attempt to get rid of me. There are comings and goings. I have a few facts."
He reached up a big index finger and laid it alongside his nose.
"But I have this."
He tapped the side of his nose as if he was patting a dog.
"But this is a good friend of mine, and I trust him."
He brought his hand slowly and significantly down onto the desk, and added softly,
"And if the stakes were not so big, I would say to you, go home, my friend. Go home. There is something here to get away from."
Kerim sat back. The tension went out of his voice. He barked out a harsh laugh.
"But we are not old women, and this is our work, so let us forget my nose and get on with the job. First of all, is there anything I can tell you that you do not know? The girl has made no sign of life since my signal, and I have no other information, but perhaps you would like to ask me some questions about the meeting."
"There's only one thing I want to know," said Bond flatly. "What do you think of this girl? Do you believe her story or not? Her story about me? Nothing else matters. If she hasn't got some sort of a hysterical crush on me, the whole business falls to the ground, and it's some complicated MGB plot we can't understand. Now, did you believe the girl?" Bond's voice was urgent, and his eyes searched the other man's face.
"Ah, my friend."
Kerim shook his head. He spread his arms wide.
"That is what I asked myself then, and it is what I ask myself the whole time since. But who can tell if a woman is lying about these things? Her eyes were bright, those beautiful, innocent eyes. Her lips were moist and parted in that heavenly mouth. Her voice was urgent and frightened at what she was doing and saying. Her knuckles were white on the guardrail of the ship. But what was in her heart?"
Kerim raised his hands.
"God alone knows."
He brought his hands down resignedly. He placed them flat on the desk and looked straight at Bond.
"There is only one way of telling if a woman really loves you, and even that way can only be read by an expert."
"Yes," said Bond dubiously. "I know what you mean. In bed."
Chapter 15. Background to a Spy. Coffee came again, and then more coffee, and the big room grew thick with cigarette smoke as the two men took each shred of evidence, dissected it, and put it aside. At the end of an hour, they were back where they had started. It was up to Bond to solve the problem of this girl, and if he was satisfied with her story, get her and the machine out of the country. Kerim undertook to look after the administrative problems. As a first step, he picked up the telephone and spoke to his travel agent, and reserved two seats on every outgoing plane for the next week, by BEA, Air France, SAS, and Turk Air.
"And now you must have a passport," he said. "One will be sufficient. She can travel as your wife. One of my men will take your photograph, and he will find a photograph of some girl who looks more or less like her. As a matter of fact, an early picture of Garbo would serve. There is a certain resemblance. He can get one from the newspaper files. I will speak to the Consul General. He's an excellent fellow who likes my little cloak-and-dagger plots. The passport will be ready by this evening. What name would you like to have?"
"Take one out of a hat."
"Somerset. My mother came from there. David Somerset. Profession, company director. That means nothing. And the girl? Let us say Caroline. She looks like a Caroline. A couple of clean-limbed young English people with a taste for travel. Finance control form? Leave that to me. It will show £80 in traveller's checks, let's say, and a receipt from the bank to show you changed 50 while you were in Turkey. Customs? They never look at anything. Only too glad if somebody has bought something in the country. You will declare some Turkish delight, presents for your friends in London. If you have to get out quickly, leave your hotel bill and luggage to me. They know me well enough at the palace. Anything else?
I can't think of anything. Karim looked at his watch.
12 o'clock. Just time for the car to take you back to your hotel. There might be a message. And have a good look at your things to see if anyone has been inquisitive.
He rang the bell and fired instructions at the head clerk, who stood with his sharp eyes on Kerim's and his lean head straining forward like a whippet's. Kerim led Bond to the door. There came again the warm, powerful hand-clasp.
"The car will bring you to lunch," he said. "A little place in the Spice Bazaar."
His eyes looked happily into Bond's.
"And I am glad to be working with you. We will do well together."
He let go of Bond's hand.
"And now I have a lot of things to do very quickly." They may be the wrong things, but at any rate," he grinned broadly, "jouons mal, mais jouons vite."
The head clerk, who seemed to be some sort of chief of staff to Kerim, led Bond through another door in the wall of the raised platform. The heads were still bowed over the ledgers. There was a short passage with rooms on either side. The man led the way into one of these, and Bond found himself in an extremely well-equipped dark room and laboratory. In 10 minutes he was out again on the street. The rolls edged out of the narrow alley and back again onto the Galata Bridge. A new concierge was on duty at the Crystal Palace, a small, obsequious man with guilty eyes and a yellow face. He came out from behind the desk, his hands spread in apology.
"Effendi, I greatly regret. My colleague showed you to an inadequate room. It was not realized that you are a friend of Kerim Bey. Your things have been moved to number 12. It is the best room in the hotel. In fact," the concierge leered, "it is the room reserved for honeymoon couples. Every comfort. My apologies, effendi. The other room is not intended for visitors of distinction."
The man executed an oily bow, washing his hands. If there was one thing Bond couldn't stand, it was the sound of his boots being licked. He looked the concierge in the eyes and said, "Oh." The eyes slid away. "Let me see this room. I may not like it. I was quite comfortable where I was."
"Certainly, effendi." The man bowed Bond to the lift. "But, alas, the plumbers are in your former room. The water supply..."
The voice trailed away. The lift rose about 10 feet and stopped at the first floor. Well, the story of the plumbers makes sense, reflected Bond. And after all, there was no harm in having the best room in the hotel. The concierge unlocked a high door and stood back. Bond had to approve. The sun streamed in through wide double windows that gave onto a small balcony. The motif was pink and grey, and the style was mock French Empire, battered by the years but still with all the elegance of the turn of the century. There were fine Bukhara rugs on the parquet floor. A glittering chandelier hung from the ornate ceiling. The bed against the right-hand wall was huge. A large mirror in a gold frame covered most of the wall behind it. Bond was amused. The honeymoon room. Surely there should be a mirror on the ceiling as well. The adjoining bathroom was tiled and fitted with everything, including a bidet and a shower. Bond's shaving things were neatly laid out. The concierge followed Bond back into the bedroom, and when Bond said he would take the room, bowed himself gratefully out. Why not? Bond again walked round the room. This time he carefully inspected the walls and the neighbourhood of the bed and the telephone. Why not take the room? Why would there be microphones or secret doors? What would be the point of them? His suitcase was on a bench near the chest of drawers. He knelt down. No scratches round the lock. The bit of fluff he had trapped in the clasp was still there. He unlocked the suitcase and took out the little attaché case. Again, no signs of interference. Bond locked the case and got to his feet. He washed and went out of the room and down the stairs. No, there had been no messages for the Effendi. The concierge bowed as he opened the door of the rolls. Was there a hint of conspiracy behind the permanent guilt in those eyes? Bond decided not to care if there was. The game, whatever it was, had to be played out. If the change of rooms had been the opening gambit, so much the better. The game had to begin somewhere. As the car sped back down the hill, Bond's thoughts turned to Darko Kerim. What a man for head of station T. His size alone in this country of furtive, stunted little men would give him authority, and his giant vitality and love of life would make everyone his friend. Where had this exuberant, shrewd pirate come from, and how had he come to work for the service? He was the rare type of man that Bond loved, and Bond already felt prepared to add Kerim to the half-dozen of those real friends whom Bond, who had no acquaintances, would be ready to take to his heart. The car went back over the Galata Bridge and drew up outside the vaulted arcades of the Spice Bazaar. The chauffeur led the way up the shallow, worn steps and into the fog of exotic scents, shouting curses at the beggars and sack-laden porters. Inside the entrance, the chauffeur turned left out of the stream of shuffling, jabbering humanity and showed Bond a small arch in the thick wall. Turret-like stone steps curled upwards.
"Effendi, you will find Kerim Bey in the far room on the left. You have only to ask. He is known to all."
Bond climbed the cool stairs to a small anteroom, where a waiter, without asking his name, took charge and led him through a maze of small, colourfully tiled, vaulted rooms to where Kerim was sitting at a corner table over the entrance to the bazaar. Kerim greeted him boisterously, waving a glass of milky liquid in which ice twinkled.
"Here you are, my friend. Now at once some raki. You must be exhausted after your sight-seeing."
He fired orders at the waiter. Bond sat down in a comfortable armed chair and took the small tumbler the waiter offered him. He lifted it towards Kerim and tasted it. It was identical with ouzo. He drank it down. At once the waiter refilled his glass.
"And now to order lunch. They eat nothing but offal cooked in rancid olive oil in Turkey. At least the offal at the Misi Kasarsi is the best."
The grinning waiter made suggestions.
"He says the doner kebab is very good today. I don't believe him, but it can be. It is very young lamb, broiled over charcoal, with savoury rice. Lots of onions in it. Or is there anything you prefer? A pilaf, or some of those damned stuffed peppers they eat here? All right, then. And you must start with a few sardines, grilled en papillote. They are just edible."
Kerim harangued the waiter. He sat back, smiling at Bond.
"That is the only way to treat these damned people. They love to be cursed and kicked. It is all they understand. It is in the blood. All this pretense of democracy is killing them. They want some sultans and wars and rape and fun. Poor brutes, in their striped suits and bowler hats. They are miserable. You've only got to look at them. However, to hell with them all. Any news?"
Bond shook his head. He told Kerim about the change of room and the untouched suitcase. Kerim downed a glass of raki and wiped his mouth on the back of his hand. He echoed the thought Bond had had.
"Well, the game must begin sometime. I have made certain small moves. Now we can only wait and see. We will make a little foray into enemy territory after lunch. I think it will interest you. Oh, we shan't be seen. We shall move in the shadows, underground."
Kerim laughed delightedly at his cleverness.
"And now let us talk about other things. How do you like Turkey? No, I don't want to know. What else?"
They were interrupted by the arrival of their first course. Bond's sardines en papillote tasted like any other fried sardines. Kerim set about a large plate of what appeared to be strips of raw fish. He saw Bond's look of interest.
"Raw fish," he said. "After this I shall have raw meat and lettuce, and then I shall have a bowl of yogurt. I am not a faddist, but I once trained to be a professional strong man. It is a good profession in Turkey. The public loves them, and my trainer insisted that I should eat only raw food. I got the habit. It is good for me, but..." He waved his fork. "I do not pretend it is good for everyone. I don't care the hell what other people eat, so long as they enjoy it. I can't stand sad eaters and sad drinkers."
Why did you decide not to be a strong man? How did you get into this racket?
Kerim forked up a strip of fish and tore at it with his teeth. He drank down half a tumbler of raki. He lit a cigarette and sat back in his chair.
Well, he said with a sour grin, we might as well talk about me as about anything else. And you must be wondering, how did this big crazy man get into the service? I will tell you, but briefly, because it is a long story. You will stop me if you get bored, all right?
Fine. Bond lit a diplomat. He leant forward on his elbows.
I come from Trebizond.
Kerim watched his cigarette smoke curl upwards.
We were a huge family with many mothers. My father was the sort of man women can't resist. All women want to be swept off their feet. In their dreams they long to be slung over a man's shoulder and taken into a cave and raped. That was his way with them. My father was a great fisherman, and his fame was spread all over the Black Sea. He went after the swordfish. They are difficult to catch and hard to fight, and he would always outdo all others after these fish. Women like their men to be heroes. He was a kind of hero in a corner of Turkey where it is a tradition for the men to be tough. He was a big, romantic sort of fellow. So he could have any woman he wanted. He wanted them all, and sometimes killed other men to get them. Naturally, he had many children. We all lived on top of each other, in a great, rambling old ruin of a house that our aunts made habitable. The aunts really amounted to a harem. One of them was an English governess from Istanbul. My father had seen watching a circus. He took a fancy to her, and she to him, and that evening he put her on board his fishing boat and sailed up the Bosphorus and back to Trebizond. I don't think she ever regretted it. I think she forgot all the world except him. She died just after the war. She was 60. The child before me had been by an Italian girl, and the girl had called him Bianco. He was fair. I was dark. I got to be called Darko. There were 15 of us children, and we had a wonderful childhood. Our aunts fought often, and so did we. It was like a gypsy encampment. It was held together by my father, who thrashed us, women or children, when we were a nuisance. But he was good to us when we were peaceful and obedient. You cannot understand such a family?
The way you describe it, I can.
Anyway, so it was. I grew up to be nearly as big a man as my father, but better educated. My mother saw to that. My father only taught us to be clean, and to go to the lavatory once a day, and never to feel shame about anything in this world. My mother also taught me a regard for England, but that is by the way. By the time I was 20, I had a boat of my own, and I was making money. But I was wild. I left the big house and went to live in 2 small rooms on the waterfront. I wanted to have my women where my mother would not know. There was a stroke of bad luck. I had a little Bessarabian hellcat. I had won her in a fight with some gypsies here in the hills behind Istanbul. They came after me, but I got her on board the boat. I had to knock her unconscious first. She was still trying to kill me when we got back to Trebizond, so I got her to my place and took away all her clothes and kept her chained naked under the table. When I ate, I used to throw scraps to her under the table like a dog. She had to learn who was master. Before that could happen, my mother did an unheard-of thing. She visited my place without warning. She came to tell me that my father wanted to see me immediately. She found the girl. My mother was really angry with me for the first time in my life. Angry? She was beside herself. I was a cruel ne'er-do-well, and she was ashamed to call me son. The girl must immediately be taken back to her people.
My mother brought her some of her own clothes from the house. The girl put them on, but when the time came, she refused to leave me. Darko Kerim laughed hugely.
An interesting lesson in female psychology, my dear friend. However, the problem of the girl is another story. While my mother was fussing over her and getting nothing but gypsy curses for her pains, I was having an interview with my father, who had heard nothing of all this and who never did hear. My mother was like that. There was another man with my father, a tall, quiet English man with a black patch over one eye. They were talking about the Russians. The Englishman wanted to know what they were doing along their frontier. about what was going on at Batum, the big oil and naval base only 50 miles away from Trebizond. He would pay good money for information. I knew English, and I knew Russian. I had good eyes and ears. I had a boat. My father had decided that I would work for the Englishman, and that Englishman, my dear friend, was Major Dancy, my predecessor as head of this station. And the rest—' Kerim made a wide gesture with his cigarette holder. "You can imagine."
"But what about this training to be a professional strongman?"
"Ah," said Kerim slyly, "that was only a sideline. Our travelling circuses were almost the only Turks allowed through the frontier. The Russians cannot live without circuses. It is as simple as that. I was the man who broke chains and lifted weights by a rope between my teeth. I wrestled against the local strongmen in the Russian villages, and some of those Georgians are giants. Fortunately, they are stupid giants, and I nearly always won. Afterwards, at the drinking, there was always much talk and gossip. I would look foolish and pretend not to understand. Every now and then I would ask an innocent question, and they would laugh at my stupidity and tell me the answer."
The second course came, and with it a bottle of Cavaclidieri, a rich, coarse burgundy, like any other Balkan wine. The kebab was good, and tasted of smoked bacon fat and onions. Kerim ate a kind of steak tartare, a large, flat hamburger of finely minced raw meat, laced with peppers and chives and bound together with yolk of egg. He made Bond try a forkful. It was delicious. Bond said so.
"You ought to eat it every day," said Kerim earnestly. "It is good for those who wish to make much love. There are certain exercises you should do for the same purpose. These things are important to men, or at least they are to me. Like my father, I consume a large quantity of women, but unlike him, I also drink and smoke too much, and these things do not go well with making love. Nor does this work I do, too many tensions and too much thinking. It takes the blood to the head instead of to where it should be for making love. But I am greedy for life. I do too much of everything all the time. Suddenly, one day, my heart will fail. The iron crab will get me, as it got my father. But I am not afraid of the crab. At least I shall have died from an honorable disease. Perhaps they will put on my tombstone, 'This man died from living too much.'"
Bond laughed. "Don't go too soon, Darko," he said. "M would be very displeased. He thinks the world of you."
"He does?"
Kerim searched Bond's face to see if he was telling the truth. He laughed delightedly.
"In that case, I will not let the crab have my body yet."
He looked at his watch.
"Come, James," he said. "It is good that you remind me of my duty. We will have coffee in the office. There is not much time to waste. Every day at 2:30 the Russians have their council of war. Today you and I will do them the honour of being present at their deliberations."
Chapter 16. The Tunnel of Rats. Back in the cool office, while they waited for the inevitable coffee, Kerim opened a cupboard in the wall and pulled out sets of engineer's blue overalls. Kerim stripped to his shorts and dressed himself in one of the suits and pulled on a pair of rubber boots. Bond picked out a suit and a pair of boots that more or less fitted him and put them on. With the coffee, the head clerk brought in two powerful flashlights, which he put on the desk. When the clerk had left the room, Kerim said,
"He is one of my sons, the eldest one. The others in there are all my children. The chauffeur and the watchman are uncles of mine. Common blood is the best security, and this spice business is good cover for us all. M set me up in it. He spoke to friends of his in the city of London. I am now the leading spice merchant in Turkey. I have long ago repaid M the money that was lent me. My children are shareholders in the business. They have a good life. When there is secret work to be done and I need help, I choose the child who will be most suitable. They all have training in different secret things. They are clever and brave. Some have already killed for me. They would all die for me. And for M, I have taught them he is just below God."
Kerim made a deprecating wave.
"But that is just to tell you that you are in good hands."
"I hadn't imagined anything different."
"Ha!"
said Kerim noncommittally. He picked up the torches and handed one to Bond.
"And now, to work."
Karim walked over to the wide glass-fronted bookcase and put his hand behind it. There was a click, and the bookcase rolled silently and easily along the wall to the left. Behind it was a small door, flush with the wall. Karim pressed one side of the door, and it swung inwards to reveal a dark tunnel with stone steps leading straight down. A dank smell mixed with faint zoo stench came out into the room.
"You go first," said Karim. "Go down the steps to the bottom and wait. I must fix the door."
Bond switched on his torch and stepped through the opening and went carefully down the stairs. The light of the torch showed fresh masonry and, 20 feet below, a glimmer of water. When Bond got to the bottom, he found that the glimmer was a small stream running down a central gutter in the floor of an ancient stone-walled tunnel that sloped steeply up to the right. To the left, the tunnel went on downwards and would, he guessed, come out below the surface of the Golden Horn. Out of range of Bond's light, there was a steady, quiet scuttling sound, and in the blackness, hundreds of pinpoints of red light flickered and moved. It was the same uphill and downhill. 20 yards away on either side, 1,000 rats were looking at Bond. They were sniffing at his scent. Bond imagined the whiskers lifting slightly from their teeth. He had a quick moment of wondering what action they would take if his torch went out. Kerim was suddenly beside him.
"It is a long climb, 1/4 hour. I hope you love animals."
Kerim's laugh boomed hugely away up the tunnel. The rats scuffled and stirred.
"Unfortunately, there is not much choice. Rats and bats, squadrons of them, divisions, a whole air force and army, and we have to drive them in front of us. Towards the end of the climb it becomes quite congested. Let's get started. The air is good. It is dry underfoot on both sides of the stream, but in winter the floods come, and then we have to use frogmen suits. Keep your torch on my feet. If a bat gets in your hair, brush him off. It will not be often. Their radar is very good."
They set off up the steep slope. The smell of the rats and of the droppings of bats was thick, a mixture of monkey house and chicken battery. It occurred to Bond that it would be days before he got rid of it. Clusters of bats hung like bunches of withered grapes from the roof, and when, from time to time, either Kerim's head or Bond's brushed against them, they exploded, twittering into the darkness. Ahead of them, as they climbed, there was the forest of squeaking, scuffling red pinpoints that grew denser on either sides of the central gutter. Occasionally, Kerim flashed his torch forward, and the light shone on a grey field sown with glittering teeth and glinting whiskers. When this happened, an extra frenzy seized the rats, and those nearest jumped on the backs of the others to get away. All the while, fighting, tumbling grey bodies came sweeping down the central gutter, and as the pressure of the mass higher up the tunnel grew heavier, the frothing rear rank came closer. The two men kept their torches levelled like guns on the rear ranks until, after a good 1/4 hour's climb, they reached their destination. It was a deep alcove of newly faced brick in the side wall of the tunnel. There were two benches on each side of a thick, tarpaulin-wrapped object that came down from the ceiling of the alcove. They stepped inside. Another few yards climb, Bond thought, and mass hysteria must have seized the distant thousands of rats further up the tunnel. The horde would have turned. Out of sheer pressure for space, the rats would have braved the lights and hurled themselves down onto the two intruders, in spite of the two glaring eyes and the threatening scent.
"Watch," said Kerim.
There was a moment of silence. Further up the tunnel, the squeaking had stopped, as if at a word of command. Then suddenly the tunnel was 1 foot deep in a great wave of hurtling, scrambling grey bodies as, with a continuous high-pitched squeal, the rats turned and pelted back down the slope. For minutes the sleek grey river foamed by outside the alcove until at last the numbers thinned and only a trickle of sick or wounded rats came limping and probing their way down the tunnel floor. The scream of the horde slowly vanished down towards the river until there was silence, except for the occasional twitter of a fleeing bat. Kerim gave a non-committal grunt.
"One of these days those rats will start dying. Then we shall have the plague in Istanbul again. Sometimes I feel guilty for not telling the authorities of this tunnel so that they can clean the place up. But I can't so long as the Russians are up here."
He jerked his head at the roof. He looked at his watch.
5 minutes to go. They will be pulling up their chairs and fiddling with their papers. There will be the three permanent men, MGB, or one of them maybe from Army Intelligence, GRU, and there will probably be three others. Two came in a fortnight ago, one through Greece and another through Persia. Another one arrived on Monday. God knows who they are or what they are here for. And sometimes the girl, Tatiana, comes in with a signal and goes out again. Let us hope she will be here today. You will be impressed. She is something.
Kerim reached up and untied the tarpaulin cover and pulled it downwards. Bond understood. The cover protected the shining butt of a submarine periscope, fully withdrawn. The moisture glistened on the thick grease of the exposed bottom joint. Bond chuckled. Where the hell did you get that from, Darko?
Turkish Navy. War surplus.
Kerim's voice did not invite further questions.
Now Q Branch in London is trying to fix some way of wiring the damn thing for sound. It's not going to be easy. The lens at the top of this is no bigger than a cigarette lighter, end on. When I raise it, it comes up to floor level in their room. In the corner of the room, where it comes up, we cut a small mouse hole. We did it well. Once, when I came to have a look, the first thing I saw was a big mouse trap with a piece of cheese on it. At least it looked big through the lens.
Kerim laughed briefly.
But there's not much room to fit a sensitive pickup alongside the lens, and there's no hope of getting in again to do any more fiddling about with their architecture. The only way I managed to install this thing was to get my friends in the Public Works Ministry to turn the Russians out for a few days. The story was that the trams going up the hill were shaking the foundations of the houses. There had to be a survey. It cost me a few £100 for the right pockets. The Public Works inspected half a dozen houses on either side of this one and declared the place safe. By that time I and the family had finished our construction work. The Russians were suspicious as hell. I gather they went over the place with a tooth comb when they got back, looking for microphones and bombs and so on. But we can't work that trick twice. Unless Q Branch can think up something very clever, I shall have to be content with keeping an eye on them. One of these days they'll give away something useful. They'll be interrogating someone we're interested in, or something of that sort.
Alongside the matrix of the periscope in the roof of the alcove, there was a pendulous blister of metal twice the size of a football. "What's that?" said Bond.
"Bottom half of a bomb. A big bomb. If anything happens to me, or if war breaks out with Russia, that bomb will be set off by radio control from my office. It is sad."
Kerim didn't look sad.
"But I fear that many innocent people will get killed besides the Russians. When the blood is on the boil, man is as unselective as nature."
Kerim had been polishing away at the hooded eyepieces between the two handlebars that stuck out on both sides of the base of the periscope. Now he glanced at his watch and bent down and gripped the two handles and slowly brought them up level with his chin. There was a hiss of hydraulics as the glistening stem of the periscope slid up into its steel sheath in the roof of the alcove. Kerim bent his head and gazed into the eyepieces and slowly inched up the handles until he could stand upright. He twisted gently. He centered the lens and beckoned to Bond.
"Just the six of them."
Bond moved over and took the handles.
"Have a good look at them," said Kerim. "I know them, but you'd better get their faces in your mind. Head of the table is their resident director. On his left are his two staff. Opposite them are the three new ones. The latest, who looks quite an important chap, is on the director's right. Tell me if they do anything except talk."
Bond's first impulse was to tell Kerim not to make so much noise. It was as if he was in the room with the Russians, as if he was sitting in a chair in the corner, a secretary, perhaps, taking shorthand of the conference. The wide, all-round lens, designed for spotting aircraft as well as surface ships, gave him a curious picture, a mouse's eye view of a forest of legs below the foredge of the table, and various aspects of the heads belonging to the legs. The director and his two colleagues were clear, serious, dull Russian faces whose characteristics Bond filed away. There was the studious, professorial face of the director, thick spectacles, lantern jaw, big forehead, and thin hair brushed back. On his left was a square wooden face with deep clefts on either side of the nose, fair hair en brosse, and a nick out of the left ear. The third member of the permanent staff had a shifty Armenian face with clever, bright almond eyes. He was talking now. His face wore a falsely humble look. Gold glinted in his mouth. Bond could see less of the three visitors. Their backs were half towards him, and only the profile of the nearest, and presumably most junior, showed clearly. This man's skin also was dark. He, too, would be from one of the southern republics. The jaw was badly shaved, and the eye in profile was bovine and dull under a thick black brow. The nose was fleshy and porous. The upper lip was long over a sullen mouth, and the beginning of a double chin. The tough black hair was cut very short, so that most of the back of the neck looked blue to the level of the tips of the ears. It was a military haircut, done with mechanical clippers. The only clues to the next man were an angry boil on the back of a fat, bald neck, a shiny blue suit, and rather bright brown shoes. The man was motionless during the whole period that Bond kept watch, and apparently never spoke. Now the senior visitor, on the right of the resident director, sat back and began talking. It was a strong, crag-like profile, with big bones and a jutting chin under a heavy brown moustache of Stalin cut. Bond could see one cold grey eye under a bushy eyebrow, and a low forehead topped by wiry grey-brown hair. This man was the only one who was smoking. He puffed busily at a tiny wooden pipe, in the bowl of which stood half a cigarette. Every now and then he shook the pipe sideways so that the ash fell on the floor. His profile had more authority than any of the other faces, and Bond guessed that he was a senior man sent down from Moscow. Bond's eyes were getting tired. He twisted the handles gently and looked round the office as far as the blurring, jagged edges of the mousehole would allow. He saw nothing of interest. Two olive-green filing cabinets, a hat-stand by the door, on which he counted six more or less identical grey Homburgs, and a sideboard with a heavy carafe of water and some glasses. Bond stood away from the eyepiece, rubbing his eyes.
"If only we could hear," Kerim said,
shaking his head sadly.
"It would be worth diamonds."
"It would solve a lot of problems," agreed Bond. Then, "By the way, Darko, how did you come on this tunnel? What was it built for?" Kerim bent and gave a quick glance into the eyepieces and straightened up.
"It is a lost drain from the Hall of Pillars," he said. "The Hall of Pillars is now a thing for tourists. It's up above us, on the heights of Istanbul, near St. Sophia. 1,000 years ago it was built as a reservoir in case of siege. It's a huge underground palace, 100 yards long and about half as broad. It was made to hold millions of gallons of water. It was discovered again, about 400 years ago, by a man called Gilius. One day I was reading his account of finding it. He said it was filled in winter from a great pipe with a mighty noise. It occurred to me that there might be another great pipe to empty it quickly if the city fell to the enemy. I went up to the Hall of Pillars and bribed the watchman and rode about among the pillars all one night in a rubber dinghy with one of my boys. We went over the walls with a hammer and an echo sounder. At one end, in the most likely spot, there was a hollow sound. I handed out more money to the Minister of Public Works, and he closed the place for a week for cleaning. My little team got busy."
Kerim ducked down again for a look through the eyepieces and went on.
"We dug into the wall above water level and came on the top of an arch. The arch was the beginning of a tunnel. We got into the tunnel and went down it. Quite exciting, not knowing where we were going to come out. And, of course, it went straight down the hill, under the Street of Books, where the Russians have their place, and out into the Golden Horn by the Galata Bridge, 20 yards away from my warehouse. So we filled in our hole in the Hall of Pillars, and started digging from my end. That was 2 years ago. It took us a year and a lot of survey work to get directly under the Russians."
Kerim laughed.
"And now I suppose one of these days the Russians will decide to change their offices. By then I hope someone else will be head of tea."
Kerim bent down to the rubber eyepieces. Bond saw him stiffen. Kerim said urgently,
"The door's opening. Quick, take over. Here she comes."
Chapter 17. Killing Time. It was 7 o'clock on the same evening, and James Bond was back in his hotel. He had had a hot bath and a cold shower. He thought that he had at last scoured the zoo smell out of his skin. He was sitting, naked except for his shorts, at one of the windows of his room, sipping a vodka and tonic and looking out into the heart of the great tragic sunset over the Golden Horn. But his eyes didn't see the torn cloth of gold and blood that hung behind the minareted stage beneath which he had caught his first glimpse of Tatyana Romanova. He was thinking of the tall, beautiful girl with a dancer's long gait who had walked through the drab door with a piece of paper in her hand. She had stood beside her chief and handed him the paper. All the men had looked up at her. She had blushed and looked down. What had that expression on the men's faces meant? It was more than just the way some men look at a beautiful girl. They had shown curiosity. That was reasonable. They wanted to know what was in the signal, why they were being disturbed, but what else? There had been slyness and contempt, the way people stare at prostitutes. It had been an odd, enigmatic scene. This was part of a highly disciplined paramilitary organization. These were serving officers, each of whom would be wary of the others, and this girl was just one of the staff, with a corporal's rank, who was now going through a normal routine. Why had they all unguardedly looked at her with this inquisitive contempt, almost as if she was a spy who had been caught and was going to be executed? Did they suspect her? Had she given herself away? But that seemed less likely as the scene played itself out. The resident director read the signal, and the other men's eyes turned away from the girl and onto him. He said something, presumably repeating the text of the signal, and the men looked glumly back at him as if the matter did not interest them. Then the resident director looked up at the girl, and the other eyes followed his. He said something with a friendly, inquiring expression. The girl shook her head and answered briefly. The other men now only looked interested. The director said one word with a question mark on the end. The girl blushed deeply and nodded, holding his eyes obediently. The other men smiled encouragement, slyly, perhaps, but with approval. No suspicion there, no condemnation. The scene ended with a few sentences from the director, to which the girl seemed to say the equivalent of, "Yes, sir," and turned and walked out of the room. When she had gone, the director said something with an expression of irony on his face, and the men laughed heartily, and the sly expression was back on their faces, as if what he had said had been obscene. Then they went back to their work. Ever since, on their way back down the tunnel, and later in Kerim's office while they discussed what Bond had seen, Bond had racked his brains for a solution to this maddening bit of dumb crambo, and now, looking without focus at the dying sun, he was still mystified. Bond finished his drink and lit another cigarette. He put the problem away and turned his mind to the girl. Tatyana Romanova. Romanov. Well, she certainly looked like a Russian princess, or the traditional idea of one. The tall, fine-boned body that moved so gracefully and stood so well. The thick sweep of hair down to the shoulders and the quiet authority of the profile. The wonderful Garbo-esque face with its curiously shy serenity. The contrast between the level innocence of the big, deep blue eyes and the passionate promise of a wide mouth, and the way she had blushed, and the way the long eyelashes had come down over the lowered eyes. Had that been the prudery of a virgin? Bond thought not. There was the confidence of having been loved in the proud breasts and the insolently lilting behind, the assertion of a body that knows what it can befall. On what Bond had seen, could he believe that she was the sort of girl to fall in love with a photograph and a file? How could one tell? Such a girl would have a deeply romantic nature. There were dreams in the eyes and in the mouth. At that age, 24, the Soviet machine would not yet have ground the sentiment out of her. The Romanov blood might well have given her a yearning for men other than the type of modern Russian officer she would meet, stern, cold, mechanical, basically hysterical, and, because of their party education, infernally dull. It could be true. There was nothing to disprove her story in her looks. Bond wanted it to be true. The telephone rang. It was Kerim.
Nothing new?
No.
Then I will pick you up at 8.
I'll be ready. Bond laid down the receiver and slowly started to put on his clothes. Kerim had been firm about the evening. Bond had wanted to stay in his hotel room and wait for the first contact to be made. A note, a telephone call, whatever it might be. But Kerim had said no. The girl had been adamant that she would choose her own time and place. It would be wrong for Bond to seem a slave to her convenience.
"This is bad psychology, my friend," Kerim had insisted. "No girl likes a man to run when she whistles. She would despise you if you made yourself too available. From your face and your dossier, she would expect you to behave with indifference, even with insolence. She would want that. She wishes to court you, to buy a kiss." Kerim had winked, from that cruel mouth. It is with an image she has fallen in love. Behave like that image. Act the part.
Bond had shrugged his shoulders. All right, Darko, I dare say you're right. What do you suggest?
Live the life you would normally. Go home now and have a bath and a drink. The local vodka is all right if you drown it with tonic water. If nothing happens, I will pick you up at 8. We will have dinner at the place of a gypsy friend of mine, a man called Vavra. He is head of a tribe. I must anyway see him tonight. He is one of my best sources. He is finding out who tried to blow up my office. Some of his girls will dance for you. I will not suggest that they should entertain you more intimately. You must keep your sword sharp. There is a saying, once a king, always a king, but once a knight is enough."
Bond was smiling at the memory of Kerim's dictum when the telephone rang again. He picked up the receiver. It was only the car. As he went down the stairs and out to Kerim in the waiting rolls, Bond admitted to himself that he was disappointed. They were climbing up the far hill through the poorer quarters above the Golden Horn when the chauffeur half turned his head and said something in a non-committal voice. Kerim answered with a monosyllable.
"He says a Lambretta is on our tail, a faceless one. It is of no importance. When I wish, I can make a secret of my movements. Often they have trailed this car for miles when there has been only a dummy in the back. A conspicuous car has its uses. They know this gypsy is a friend of mine, but I think they do not understand why. It will do no harm for them to know that we are having a night of relaxation. On a Saturday night with a friend from England, anything else would be unusual."
Bond looked back through the rear window and watched the crowded streets. From behind a stopped tram, a motor scooter showed for a minute, and then was hidden by a taxi. Bond turned away. He reflected briefly on the way the Russians ran their centres, with all the money and equipment in the world, while the Secret Service put against them a handful of adventurous, underpaid men like this one, with his second-hand Rolls and his children to help him. Yet Kerim had the run of Turkey. Perhaps, after all, the right man was better than the right machine. At 8:30 they stopped halfway up a long hill on the outskirts of Istanbul at a dingy-looking open-air café with a few empty tables on the pavement. Behind it were the tops of trees over a high stone wall. They got out and the car drove off. They waited for the Lambretta, but its wasp-like bars had stopped, and at once it was on its way back down the hill. All they saw of the driver was a glimpse of a short, squat man wearing goggles. Kerim led the way through the tables and into the café. It seemed empty, but a man rose up quickly from behind the till. He kept one hand below the counter. When he saw who it was, he gave Kerim a nervous, white smile. Something clanged to the floor. He stepped from behind the counter and led them out through the back and across a stretch of gravel to a door in the high wall and, after knocking once, unlocked it and waved them through. There was an orchard with plank tables dotted about under the trees. In the centre was a circle of terrazza dancing floor. Round it were strung fairy lights, now dead, on poles planted in the ground. On the far side, at a long table, about 20 people of all ages had been sitting eating, but they had put down their knives and now looked towards the door. Some children had been playing in the grass behind the table. They also were now quiet and watching. The three-quarter moon showed everything up brightly and made pools of membraned shadow under the trees. Kerim and Bond walked forward. The man at the head of the table said something to the others. He got up and came to meet them. The rest returned to their dinner and the children to their games. The man greeted Kerim with reserve. He stood for a few moments making a long explanation, to which Kerim listened attentively, occasionally asking a question. The gypsy was an imposing theatrical figure in Macedonian dress, white shirt with full sleeves, baggy trousers, and laced soft leather top boots. His hair was a tangle of black snakes. A large, downward-drooping black moustache almost hid the full red lips. The eyes were fierce and cruel on either side of a syphilitic nose. The moon glinted on the sharp line of the jaw and the high cheekbones. His right hand, which had a gold ring on the thumb, rested on the hilt of a short, curved dagger in a leather scabbard tipped with filigree silver. The gypsy finished talking. Kerim said a few words, forceful and apparently complimentary, about Bond, at the same time stretching his hand out in Bond's direction, as if he was a compere in a nightclub commending a new turn. The gypsy stepped up to Bond and scrutinized him. He bowed abruptly. Bond followed suit. The gypsy said a few words through a sardonic smile. Kerim laughed and turned to Bond.
"He says if you are ever out of work, you should come to him. He will give you a job, taming his women and killing for him. That is a great compliment to a Gajo, a foreigner. You should say something in reply."
"Tell him that I can't imagine he needs any help in these matters." Kerim translated. The gypsy politely bared his teeth. He said something and walked back to the table, clapping his hands sharply. Two women got up and came towards him. He spoke to them curtly, and they went back to the table and picked up a large earthenware dish and disappeared among the trees. Kerim took Bond's arm and led him to one side.
"We have come on a bad night," he said. "The restaurant is closed. There are family troubles here which have to be solved, drastically and in private. But I am an old friend, and we are invited to share their supper. It will be disgusting, but I have sent for Raki. Then we may watch, but on condition that we do not interfere. I hope you understand, my friend."
Kerim gave Bond's arm an additional pressure.
"Whatever you see, you must not move or comment. A court has just been held, and justice is to be done, their kind of justice. It is an affair of love and jealousy. Two girls of the tribe are in love with one of his sons. There is a lot of death in the air. They both threaten to kill the other to get him."
This book is continued on Disc 5.